I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young at Boston's Fleet Center.
It's Here and Now.
Our vote was soaked in the blood of martyrs, soaked in the blood of Goodman, Cheney, and Sanna, soaked in the blood of four little girls in Birmingham. This vote is sacred to us. This vote can't be bargained away. This vote can't be given away.
Al Sharpton taking off the gloves last night. John Edwards also spoke last night and began to make the case for John Kerry for president. But tonight, John Kerry is on the podium and on his own. We spoke today with Clinton campaign manager and Democratic consultant James Carville. James Carville, what does Senator Kerry have to say tonight to erase the perception among some that he's a flip-flopper on the war on Iraq? He voted for the war. Many of his constituents were against it.
He voted to authorize. He didn't vote for the war. I mean, the first thing. And I don't know that all of that is necessary because President Bush has so bungled this war, such ill planning. And I think what people are looking for is not a debate over what we went to war. We acknowledge that's a mistake now. But what we want to know is who has the strength, the vision, and the wisdom to come up with a plan to help us get our troops out of there, to get other people to cooperate, to convince the Iraqi people that there's a better way to do this. And, of course, that's going to be him.
But you're saying this very clearly, but Senator Kerry apparently hasn't. I mean, there are a lot of people who still question his stand on the war and see him as being wishy-washy on it.
The Republicans have put $100 million of ads up, and Senator Kerry's still ahead if you look at most of the polls. And, you know, that's part of politics. But I think he'll do a really good job tonight. I have very... very, you know, high expectations for him. I think he'll fulfill those.
Quick question. I heard someone just say that Al Sharpton went off message last night. Some people are saying, why do the Democrats, why are they requiring people to be on message? Why are the scripts so vetted? Why is this such a tightly wound Democratic convention?
Well, I mean, any campaign, a party wants to kind of get a message out, and you want to repeat it over and over. I guess what I'm sort of fascinated by is anybody would be surprised about that.
Because the Democrats are the ones who allow many different voices normally. There's floor fights. There haven't been floor fights. There hasn't been any...
The Democratic Party is more united than it's ever been. And, you know, our role here is not to amuse the news media. Our role here is to inform the American people. And I think they're doing a good job of that. And, you know, the party's just united. I mean, I've never seen it like this before.
Democratic consultant James Carville speaking on the floor of the Democratic Convention this morning.
Well, last night, Democratic vice presidential nominee John Edwards did his bit to remind the American people how united the party is.
When your brother calls and says he's spending his entire life at the office and he still can't get ahead, you tell him hope is on the way. When your parents call and tell you their medicine's going through the roof, they can't keep up, you tell them hope is on the way.
Edwards, of course, is on the ticket in part because of his skill as a public speaker. John Kerry, on the other hand, well, he's renowned for many things, but public speaking is not one of them. Tonight really is the biggest speech of his life. Kerry's had no shortage of advice from all quarters about what he needs to say, about what the American people want to hear. Now, joining me in the studio is David Nyhan, former Boston Globe columnist and longtime observer of the Massachusetts political scene. He's been following Kerry's career since the candidate's days as a prosecutor just outside Boston. And David, what do you think John Kerry's speech should say? How difficult is it? Will it be for him to write? Is he writing it?
I'm sure he has a lot of help doing it. Kerry's always had the reputation of being a hands-on tinkerer with text. He has the input of Robert Schrum, Teddy Kennedy's longtime liberal conservative basher. Kerry has to sell himself to people who haven't been paying attention. My theory, Michael, is that there's going to be very little bounce out of either convention because the voters are so divided and firmly divided. There's not much loose water slopping around in the bilge, so to speak. And Kerry is going to go out of his way to emphasize national security. He's got to meet the "will he protect us from terror" threshold. And I think domestic concerns, and he wasn't going to get the vote of the top 2% of taxpayers anyway, so he might as well say, we'll raise taxes on those suckers and everybody else gets the gravy.
But let's just come back to the specifics on Iraq. Certainly the people who put the demands from the Fourth Estate, the editorial writers at the big papers thing, you got to explain that vote on Iraq in the autumn of 2002 and what you're going to do differently if elected president.
Well, if Kerry does not get and already have locked up the editorial page endorsement of the New York Times, I'll eat this microphone, number one. Number two, this is the last point at which you can exercise leverage, and you've got to tell them that the great task of leadership is to disappoint your followers. As Herman Hickman, when he was football coach at Yale, used to say about the alumni should be kept sullen but not mutinous. Kerry is going to have to keep the left sullen but not mutinous as he reaches towards the center.
Well, actually, this week, it's hardly been sullen, the left around Boston. I mean, you
they
have
want
been,
to win. It's about winning, baby.
I tell you, it's an extraordinary way to look at doing politics.
Listen, what the Democrats are doing is stage managing and keeping on message a convention that's on rails. You saw it with every speaker being sanitized except when Al Sharpton, you know, hijacked the mic last night. They want to win. They all want to win. And I think this convention will conclude quite happily. And I think New York will be a different story. I think a lot of guff in New York.
You've been covering politics here forever, from before the time John Kerry was a politician. Part of the speech has to be what he says. Most of the speech has to be the way he's able to project a personal style. Has he ever been able to project a warm personal style?
No. He's always been about competence, focus, nuance, and rigorous, tough campaigning. We know that he's not afraid to pull the trigger. He jumped off a swift boat in the Mekong Delta and pulled the trigger on a guy pointing an RPG at him. He is a ferocious campaigner, a very skillful debater. He's like a prosecutor. He wants to get into the details, and he's not a guy like Edwards who just oozes feel-goodism.
Mm. Mm. David, would you have ever have thought that American history would come to this, that two guys who did not fight in Vietnam, avoided service, would be elected president, and one guy who fought in Vietnam would be defeated in an election, and a second guy, John Kerry, decorated combat veteran, would face this extraordinary fight? You know, back in the early 70s, it was almost the kiss of death if you didn't go. People said, well, he'll have no career in public life. He didn't serve in Vietnam.
It's astonishing, Michael, how this convention is more about Vietnam than it is about Iraq, because the simple truth is no one has a good answer for Iraq, certainly not the Bush administration, and Kerry has to be very wary. The thing that most impressed me last night, not of the speeches of Edwards and Sharpton and so forth, but when the general, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when he came out and endorsed Kerry and Edwards, having been fired or forced to retire early because he acknowledged they needed more troops on the ground, more boots in Baghdad, and he was canned for it, just in the same way Jay Garner was cashiered out there. If you're not with the program with these guys, out you go. And I think that was potentially more meaningful for the success of the ticket in places like your panhandle in Florida.
Dave Nihan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Michael.
David Nihan is a former Boston Globe columnist and longtime observer of the Massachusetts political scene. There was also supposed to be a political convention of a different sort this weekend in Baghdad. It was billed as a major stepping stone on the way to elections next January. 1,000 community and tribal leaders were going to meet and select a 100-member national council to work alongside the interim government in the months leading up to the elections. But today, the meeting was postponed. The question is, was it for security reasons following yesterday's bloody suicide bombing in Bakuba, or was it politics? Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Pamela Constable, correspondent for The Washington Post. Hello, Pamela.
Hello, hello.
Okay, Pam, why was the meeting postponed, security or politics?
It was definitely politics. There were strong hints that it was going to be postponed already. The United Nations had asked the conference organizers to delay it last week because they simply weren't ready. There were too many problems, both logistical and political, too many important groups that did not want to participate, just too many problems for it to come off successfully on very short notice.
I think logistical problems we can all imagine, but what were some of the political problems?
Well, there was a lot of disagreement in various parts of the country about how people would be selected to participate in the conference. In one city in the north, for example, there, as you know, many parts of Iraq are multi-ethnic, and this particular city had, I think, three or four major ethnic groups, and they were all arguing about what should be the proportional representation of ethnic groups at the conference, and they were simply unable to agree, and so the elections for that city for delegates had to be annulled, and the conference leaders were frantically trying to meet with leaders in that city today and yesterday, but I suspect they weren't able to make much headway.
What was the conference supposed to achieve?
It was, and presumably still will, achieve two things. Legally, it's supposed to, as you suggested earlier, set up a kind of mini legislative council of 100 members that would be from a cross section of society and that would have certain kinds of oversight over the interim executive branch, certain veto powers on appointments, and the ability to investigate and to have a say in policy. But the other function of it was more, I suppose, psychological or political in nature. It was to have some sort of a venue for groups from all walks of life, religious, political, and civic, as well as tribal, to come together in some sort of a forum where they could discuss things, in a civilized manner, as well as performing some sort of legislative or quasi-legislative function.
Now, just a quick change of subject. Interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi was in Saudi Arabia, and he met with Secretary of State Powell and Saudi leaders. And the Saudis made a proposal about Muslim countries putting together a multinational peacekeeping force to send to Iraq. How is this playing in Baghdad? Do Iraqis give the idea any credence?
I think so. I think it has a certain obvious appeal because, there's been a lot of resentment here of the international forces, particularly because of the American domination of them. And, as the time has gone by, there have been incidents and confrontations. So I think everyone is desperately looking for some alternative. The Iraqi government has proposed this, not just the Saudis. In fact, the Iraqis sent out letters to many, many countries in the region, Muslim countries, asking if they would contribute to a force independently of the Saudi effort. So this is something that that officials here, I think, and the public would welcome. The question is really more, is it feasible to put together politically from the point of view of various countries in the region?
Pamela Constable, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Pamela Constable is correspondent for The Washington Post, and she was speaking to us from Baghdad.
Just ahead, we hear from Ann Richards. She was the governor of Texas till George W. Bush came along.
And later in the show, the Democratic National Convention, as reported by the satirists at The Daily Show.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young at Boston's Fleet Center.
It's Here and Now.
There are hundreds of caucuses and parties across Boston this week, serving as part pep rally for DNC delegates, part fundraiser for the party, with speakers less constrained than those at the podium at the Fleet Center. We elbowed our way to the podium this week with former Texas Governor Ann Richards at an event held at the Sullivan and Worcester Law Firm, honoring women leaders in the Democratic Party. Richards was the keynote speaker in 1988. She famously said George H.W. Bush was born with a silver foot in his mouth. Well, I asked her if she felt constrained now by the Kerry campaign call for positivity and no Bush bashing.
Well, I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying tell the message. Undecided voters in this country are roughly 4%. That 4% is principally women. They are working women who are pulled in all different directions. the war in Iraq is something that they oppose, but it is not a motivator for them to get to the polls.
So what's missing? What's wrong? Why aren't those people moving to John Kerry?
Oh, they're going to vote for John Kerry. The question is whether they vote or not. It's always a question of motivation. Somehow we have to reach these women and say, beginning on August the 3rd, you are no longer going to be able to get compensatory time unless your boss just wants to give it to you for the work that you've done overtime. Preschool, Head Start, job training, you name it. It's had a red line in the Bush administration budget.
Of course, there are Republican spinmeisters here in a war room who would want to debate you on every one of those points.
I think the Bush administration has given us tremendous opportunity. I feel very positive about this election.
I was trying to explain to some people back here from NPR that I really sympathize and I really support John Kerry's attitude that we must be positive in this election. And I feel extremely positive about policies and laws that are going to help American families, that are going to help American women instead of repressing us and making our communities unsafe, cutting our forests down. Suddenly telling us that we're going to have prescription drugs and those of us who care for our parents really believing it and find out that it's a total sham. So I'm just saying how positive I feel. How totally positive I feel that next year is going to be a new year when John is sworn in. I was not the first woman to be governor of Texas. Most people think that I was. There was a woman before me whose name was Ma Ferguson. A driving issue at the time was whether or not children were going to be punished if they spoke Spanish in the public schools. And she said that if the English language was good enough for Jesus Christ... It was good enough for the school children in Texas. And I wanted to share that with you so that you would know that some of us in Texas have learned something over the past 70-plus years. But I don't want to rush to disabuse you of the notion that there are still a hardcore group of people that still believe that Jesus spoke English. And they are the center of the Republican Party and supporters of George W. Bush. Not only are they misguided and misled on this issue, but they are misguided and are misleading on a number of other issues. So God bless you and get every woman you know to the polls because they're going to vote Democrat. God bless you.
Robin Young spoke with Ann Richards in Boston earlier this week. With the convention in full swing, producer Karen Miller-Medson checked in with some delegates on the floor last night.
My name is Larry Mullins from Morristown, Tennessee.
Are you hearing anything that's interesting you, anything that you didn't expect to hear?
No, I'm hearing what's right on target. We need a new America and job security and foreign trade. So those kind of policy changes is what we need, and that's what we're hearing. I think Tennessee's going to win for the Democrats this year.
Dale Henry, Springfield, Ohio.
This convention.
I hear a message of unity and solidarity and progress for the whole country.
Ohio's a swing state. It might be tough.
I've already seen where a lot of people who voted Republican before have switched over to Democrat. And I think that the independents will be persuaded just by the turn of the events in the last few months.
I'm with the Arizona delegation, Joel Rios.
Now, are you hearing a message here tonight that you think will convince voters in Arizona to vote Democrat?
I'm hoping to carry the message home and try to make sure that they vote Democrat.
Quality public schools and dedicated teachers. My name is Arlene Miller. I'm from Bergen County, New Jersey.
Did the speeches live up to your expectations?
I think some of them were incredible. I thought Bill Clinton was absolutely incredible.
Donna Lyon from Lexington, Kentucky. The messages that have been delivered now over three evenings are all encompassing. It's what is good for the American people over the next 4 years, maybe 8 years, maybe 12 years. The speech is Monday night. Jimmy Carter, I said to myself, I said, if Jimmy were running, I'd put him in office another four, even though he's almost 82.
Are you looking forward to Kerry?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Looking forward to Kerry and the campaign over the next 96 days.
Delegates speaking on the floor of the convention, stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young at the Democratic National Convention.
It's here and now.
The most recent polls show that Americans want to hear specifics from John Kerry tonight. And the last Washington Post poll showed respondents increasingly saw President Bush as better able to deal with Iraq than John Kerry. Earlier today, we caught up with Ron Brownstein, political commentator for the Los Angeles Times. He was on the floor of the DNC, and we asked him what he thinks Kerry needs to accomplish tonight.
I think that the key task for John Kerry, as described by their own campaign in this convention, is to convince people that he will be credible as commander-in-chief, that he can keep them safe. That is the card they are playing heaviest, both in the sense of emphasizing his Vietnam experience in a very specific way, arguing that he made life-and-death decisions under fire, and therefore you can trust him in a crisis, and also in so aggressively challenging President Bush's record on national security, homeland security, and the way he has fought the war on terror.
But what does he have to say when the Bush administration fires back, but you voted for authorization of the war and now you're criticizing it?
Well, that has been his dilemma from day one. You know, what John Kerry has argued is that George Bush has not fought the war the way that John Kerry wanted him to. And this is the dilemma of a legislator. You know, you do not control the executive. You do not have the finely grained nuance of choice that is available to the president. You are given a binary choice, up or down. He ultimately voted up, but he argues that he had all sorts of caveats and conditions and directions of the way he wanted President Bush to go. Now, in the end, is that going to be persuasive to the American people? I don't know. But I do think that regardless of what Kerry did in September of 2002, he does have the opportunity to say he is offering a different direction now. And I'm not sure yet which one is going to prove more relevant.
How do you think the Democrats have done so far in getting across their message?
I think it's kind of been a mixed success for the convention. I mean, it seems to me a lot like 2000, where Bill Clinton was very good on the first night and then not much else happened on the next two nights. They have driven home one message with great pile driver repetition. John Kerry was tested under fire. You can trust him in a crisis. I'm not sure they've succeeded on a couple of other fronts. Until John Edwards last night, there was very little discussion of his plan. Obviously, he needs to do more
of that tonight. I think they've made very little progress on humanizing him and showing what he's like when the cameras aren't on. Apart from the testimony from his Vietnam crewmates, I thought Teresa Hines-Carey's speech was an enormous missed opportunity. It was more about her than him, and when she talked about him, it was about the public, not the private John Kerry. And third, I think they've done very little to connect the Vietnam experience to his political career. They haven't really shown how the kind of qualities that they say he exemplified in Vietnam, which most people feel he did exemplify in Vietnam, have translated into his political career, leading Republicans to say, I think with some justification, that they are slighting the Senate record. The Republicans want to argue that in the Senate, Kerry showed the opposite of what he showed in Vietnam, you know, irresolve, a lack of willingness to take a tough stand and stick to it. So I think they still have a lot of work to do tonight.
Ron Brownstein, LA Times, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, the youngest delegate of the 2004 Democratic National Convention, Sarah Bender from Medina High School in Medina, Ohio.
The Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands.
What was that like, Dad?
It was emotional for me. I'm telling you, I'm still a little choked. She did a good job.
Greg Bender's daughter, Sarah, will turn 18 by November, so she is eligible to be a delegate and has discovered that with journalists outnumbering delegates 6-1, she's a delegate in demand. When she got a break from her live interviews, I asked her, why did she choose Kerry?
When I first got into all this, I went online and researched all the different candidates. And at that point, nobody thought Kerry had a chance. But I decided he was best represented me anyhow, and so I decided to go.
How so? What was it about him?
His beliefs on education and his views on the world are similar to mine, and what he wants to do with our jobs and our economy. One-third of the jobs lost have been from Ohio. And so that's something we need to turn around. I really think that our future is best at hands with a president who has experience and who has surrounded himself with the best people and who's got the middle class people's best interests at hand.
What do you, especially as a 17-year-old, almost 18-year-old, what do you think needs to happen to get more people your age as interested as you are in politics?
The candidates need to be out there at places where young people are, and they need to talk more about the issues that young people want to hear about.
What kind of issues do you care about as relates to your age? I mean, to think of jobs as a 17-year-old is not something most 17-year-olds think of. What other issues are you thinking of?
Education, the war in Iraq. As far as jobs go, Ohio is the leading state for young kids who have just graduated college and stuff moving out of the state to find jobs. So it is something that is very close to us and very real for my age group.
What about the war in Iraq? John Kerry, your candidate, voted to authorize, to give the president authorization for the war.
I think that when we went to war, many people in our country thought things were going to be a lot different than they did. They thought we had a plan. They thought we were going over there for a reason. And then when we got there and we found out what was going on, many people were very disappointed and very angered.
You're okay with the fact that he voted for it, and now some people say it's a flip-flop.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think that people felt that there was real reason for us going over there. And once we got over there, and they thought we had a plan for once we got over there. And once we got over there and they saw what was going on and what was happening, many people changed their minds. And I think that's perfectly fine.
What would you say to people who 17-year-olds who say, oh, politics, so boring?
I see where they can say that. I do. But I would hopefully be able to talk to them and encourage them and get them to realize how much it really does affect them. In their future.
How have you felt here? I mean, obviously you've become a media sensation. What's it been like to suddenly get here and have all this happen?
It's been interesting, to say the least. I mean, it's very cool to do interviews with people from, like, I did an interview yesterday with somebody from Barcelona. That's so cool to me.
The gentleman from Florida that's the oldest.
Yeah.
He wanted to talk to you, so...
Who does?
And so 17-year-old Sarah Bender, the convention's youngest delegate, was whisked away to meet the oldest, 90-year-old E.G. Red Lackey of Florida.
Here, we're going to get a picture for MTV.
And this note, Francis Crick, one of two scientists who cracked the DNA code, has died. Crick and his colleague James Watson discovered the spiral double helix structure of DNA in 1953, paving the way for countless avenues of genetic research, from the human genome to genetically engineered foods. The discovery earned them the Nobel Prize. Though British-born, Crick lived in the United States for many years. He died in California at the age of 88.
Still to come, that chin, that hair. We speak to one cartoonist about finding inspiration in a certain face.
And the hottest TV news show covering the convention. We speak to one of the comic correspondents of The Daily Show.
You're listening to Here and Now. On Friday, the Carrie Edwards team embarks on a cross-country tour, stopping first at two important swing states, Pennsylvania, and then on Saturday to the Republican-leaning state of West Virginia. So how does candidate Carrie appeal to conservative voters there? I pose that question to the venerable senior senator from West Virginia, Robert Byrd.
Well, let's pay less attention to labels. Let's stay with the man who will keep his promise. Why do I believe that? I've served as John Kerry for several years in the U.S. Senate. He's a worker, he's strong, and he will keep his promises. He's going into West Virginia, has been there a number of times, will be there a number of times more. Jay Rockefeller and I have advised, if I might use that word, John Kerry to get down there with those common people, get a little coal dust in his hair.
Well, but as you well know, there are a lot of your constituents who also think Democrats are too anti-gun, too pro-environment, too pro-gay marriage. How does he get those potential swing voters to believe that he also stands for them, if they're more conservative, as they are in your state and other states?
Now, I don't see him as being anti-gun. I'm not anti-gun. I'm supporting him.
He has been seen with a gun, in fact, duck hunting.
Yes, he has.
Yeah, but overall, Democrats are considered that by some of these important swing voters.
I can understand that. But let's look not so much at party, even. Let's look at principles.
You have often been critical of President Bush. But is this a dangerous tack to take right now in election year when the Kerry campaign is saying they want less Bush bashing, less negative about President Bush?
My negatives are there, but they're not against Mr. Bush as a human being. My negatives are against his policies, which subvert the Constitution. And when the Constitution is circumvented, the people's liberties are in danger.
A lot of people are saying that they see this as the most important election of their lifetime.
I see it that way, likewise. We have to get away from this administration. We have to send them away from the White House. You got some of the same people who were there when Nixon was there. This is a reckless presidency, a president who says he doesn't have to explain to anyone. How about that? He has not received a mandate from the American people. He was elected by a Supreme Court that intruded. He lost the popular election. Al Gore won the popular election.
Then how do you get across to the American people that John Kerry will make them safer? Because in some people's minds, all they care about is being safe and secure, and they believe that George Bush is going to do that.
People are wrong who say that George Bush makes them safe and secure. He voted, and his people in the Congress, the Republican-controlled Congress, voted down time after time after time amendments that I offered myself for Homeland Security, to increase Homeland Security. You say they can trust him with their security? No. The Bush administration has very recently said we'll in all likelihood be attacked again by Al-Qaeda. Then why do they sit there? Why does the president sit there and not do nothing to urge his leadership in Congress to support the Homeland Security Appropriation Bill? There it sits. The American people have been told that their liberties or their lives are in danger. They've been told that by this administration. Well, this is the same administration that failed to urge the leaders of Congress, the Republican leaders, to get behind that Homeland Security Appropriation Bill, provide more money for border control, provide more money for port security, provide more money for airport security, provide more money for the first responders. Don't believe them when they tell you that they will more ably secure the American people. Don't believe it.
Senator Byrd, thank you very much for your time.
Bless your heart.
West Virginia Senior Senator Robert Byrd.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young at Boston's Fleet Center.
It's Here and Now.
A convention is a political journalist's dream, but a tightly scripted convention is a nightmare. And with 15,000 members of the media vying for untold angles, unique stories are hard to come by. Well, syndicated political cartoonist Kevin Kelleher is focusing closely on a face. Kelleher draws for The Economist magazine. His rendering of John Kerry is on the cover this week. He also draws for the Baltimore Sun, where he's keeping an illustrated diary of his quest for FaceTime with the Democratic nominee. Here and Now producer Andrea Shea spoke with the cartoonist about his first step to get close to the people who will be closest to Kerry as he gets ready to take the stage.
I managed to track down the two hairdressers from Boston who have been chosen by the DNC to be the official convention hairdressers, who behind the scenes are going to be touching up everybody's hair before they go on stage. I had an opportunity to talk with them, and let's face it, you know, last January, John Kerry's hair was still out of control. And suddenly, it's now so neat and tight and tidy. In some ways, it's a little bit of a reflection of the guy that he is now. They want a tight and tidy candidate, nothing out of place. They want to present the absolute best person when he goes on stage. And so I want to use hair as a metaphor for the guy that we're going to see.
And now you're covering this. It's a diary entry. So installment number one or day number one of your journal, you decide you're going to go get close to the hair. And then what happens day number two?
Well, day number two, I felt that I had to experience what it was like to be behind stage for these people just before they come on. So I decided to go down and get a makeover and have them walk me through what they would try to do when they see somebody come in. But they also told me a little bit about the science of what's involved in trying to make somebody look good. And then we will go off and talk about Kerry, and I'll do caricatures of him, what he looks like now, of course, with all the bits done to him, because looks do give impressions about people. Then I would also talk about the problems that he has dealing after Clinton was on earlier this week and what a rock star he is. Image matching up to someone like that's going to be hard for him.
Now, John Kerry's face is on the cover of The Economist magazine, which you also write for. I mean, it's this long face. Maybe you can describe it.
Well, one of the curious things as I've been looking at Kerry's face over time is that I realize now what I think he looks like. He looks like Jacques Cousteau with a giant Brillo pad on his head. And also it adds his face, if you took his hair away, you know, the deep, dark holes around his eyes and the way his nose is sort of curled down. It's not a particularly attractive face, but the hair really softens it in a big way. So, you know, it does sound sort of rather flippant to sort of say, yeah, hair, and let's go on that angle. But, you know, I think there's a lot more to it than one might first think.
I'm looking at your drawings of John Kerry here, and you've got an image of him that you're working with here with this extremely long face and this hair. Will that change over time?
Oh, they do. They all do. In fact, the early caricatures of anyone usually closely resemble photographs. And over time, as both the caricatures get familiar with the face and as the cartoon-consuming audience also gets familiar, the cartoonists will exaggerate and pull almost to the point where 4 years from now, the caricature, if you line a caricature up against a photograph, they wouldn't look alike, but everyone would know that that's the person. Now, of course, we're starting off with Kerry with a very exaggerated face, because he does have one. I can imagine that even in 4 years' time, the hair would be huge and the chin, you know, in fact, fitting it into a cartoon is going to be very difficult.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been my pleasure.
Kevin Kelleher's cartoons can be seen on the cover of this week's Economist magazine and in the Baltimore Sun. He's also a contributor to the new book, Attack of the Political Cartoonists. To see some of Kevin Kelleher's work, visit our website, here-now.org.
And now for the news from America's fastest-growing news source.
Tonight, from Boston, it's the Democratic National Convention. Featuring black people, trial lawyers, abortions for everybody, organized labor, godless sodomites, and celebrities who believe in their hearts they're helping, but aren't.
The Daily Show on Comedy Central, anchored by Jon Stewart, is a news program, well, sort of, that's become, for many of its viewers, the main source of news this political season. Indeed, this week one of the hottest tickets in town has been to the show's taping at a studio here on the campus of Boston University. Lewis Black is the show's political correspondent, and he's on the line to talk about the Daily Show's coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Lewis, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, just to be serious to start, I mean, last Sunday at the Shorenstein Center at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, the main anchors, looking like Mount Rushmore, were talking to the people about how they were going to cover the convention and or not cover the convention, as it's turned out. And there was a question from the floor noting that Comedy Central's Daily Show has become a genuine source of news and not just of laughter. Why do you think that is?
A, because it's become a source of news for kids. And it's because we have a point of view, and mainly because we're funny. I mean, that's the thing. That's what the attraction is.
So the inevitable outgrowth of the notion of infotainment, which has crept into the main news shows on the big networks and certainly as part of the cable news way of talking about politics, you've just taken it to the next degree. I mean, what have you noticed this week that is actually news, since this has been a fairly well stage managed, not often an oxymoronic concept when talking about Democratic Party conventions, but it's been a well-managed convention.
Oh, yeah, it's just disturbing. And the Republicans will be just as disturbing. It's literally like talking about a commercial. There's no news. It's, what was the commercial? Was the commercial good?
So where do you find humor, then?
Oh, well, I mean, last night, Hope is on the Way. I mean, what planet are you on? I will eventually have 5 minutes about Hope is on the Way.
You're going to do 5 minutes of Hope is on the Way?
Eventually, yes. Eventually, I will start tonight. I will start to talk about it, and then I will refine it and refine it. But you can't say there's a mother sitting in a thing worrying about her two children, and they don't have health insurance. Hope is on the Way. What? Does she get up from the table, go to the door, and listen to the sound of the wind? It was the repetition of it that was just spectacular.
Yes, well, it seems that the Democratic Party, everyone has at least spent one Sunday morning in a storefront church in the ghetto.
It's all concepts. Nothing that we're getting anymore is real. Nothing.
But here's the thing, Lewis. You're a comic, but say an observer and a commentator as well. But there's 15,000 hacks, journalists. We call ourselves hacks. Somebody's got to be able to shake the tree a little bit to get people slightly off message and make some news.
Yeah, but it's not happening. I mean, the way I cover this convention is I don't get on the floor. So I wander around the city just trying to find out what the effect is on the city. I'm not really looking for news. I'm really looking for jokes.
So I'm not looking for news. I'm looking for jokes. See, there's the truth. People who are watching The Daily Show, your work method is you really aren't looking for news. You're looking for jokes.
Yeah, we are.
What have you seen out in Boston that you think is worth commenting on?
I got him to come down yesterday. I wanted a shot of the Fleet Center. It's just a spectacular shot of it looks as if the Fleet Center is literally rising out of the rubble of Baghdad. There's a shot down here, from Faneuil Hall, that area. Mm-hmm. If you look up at the Fleet Center, it's nothing but your Big Dig.
Yeah, it's the Big Dig, which was supposed to be finished in time for this convention, didn't quite get finished.
It's never going to be finished. I was talking to the guys. It's a full employment economy here. It's the smartest thing I've ever seen. It's really that whole concept of having a war that goes on continually. Have a public works project that goes on continually. You guys have discovered the secret to keeping a full employment economy.
Okay, one last question, Lewis. Everybody has their expectations for John Kerry. He's being told from all quarters what it is he needs to do tonight. What do you think he needs to do tonight?
I think he just needs to speak English. I wish somebody would.
Lewis Black, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Lewis Black is political correspondent for The Daily Show, which can be seen every night on Comedy Central.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.